Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. Opera in the Ozarks opens its 63rd festival season this week. Three operas performed in repertory. This music is from one, Donizetti's enchanting Elisir d'Amore, The Elixir of Love. The others, Puccini's Madama Butterfly and the ever-popular Gilbert and Sullivan Pirates of Penzance. Tom Cockrell, the music director, is my guest, and I caught him just before he left Arizona, where he is director of choral activities and music director of the Opera Theatre at the University of Arizona School of Music, to head for Inspiration Point in Arkansas for 8 weeks of immersion opera in all its aspects. This is his third season as overall music director with opera in the Ozarks, but the first time I've been able to ask him a bit about himself, such as when did his love of opera begin?
The very first full opera I conducted was the Marriage of Figaro. It was not with the orchestra, but my wife and I were living in Rome at the time, and she was playing in the Santa Cecilia Orchestra. She's a violist, wonderful violist. And I was there studying with great Italian maestro Franco Ferrara. And there were a bunch of Americans there. We actually had a little apartment at the American church there, so we were sort of already part of a little American community, and a bunch of singers there studying voice, but with nothing to do. So we decided, okay, well, let's American ingenuity, let's throw together a production, and we did. We cast it, and we went around to the local butcher and baker and candlestick maker and asked them to make a contribution to be in the program, which in Italy in the early 1980s, that was a totally foreign idea, that idea of private subvention of the arts. But there were these crazy Americans doing that, so they got a taste of it. And, of course, you know, that is more and more so throughout Europe. So we did the Marriage of Figaro, four performances.
In Italian.
In there, yeah, in Italian, with a harpsichord and piano. Fully staged, fully costumed. It was a beautiful experience, and that was the first production that I did.
Do you have a bird in the background?
I don't. It's my cell phone. It's my notification for text messages. Uh-huh. It sounds like a bird, but it's some little bird bothering me. So I'm going to turn that down so that we don't have any more chirping.
Mm-hmm. So when was your first visit to opera in the Ozarks?
Well, I started as artistic director in 2011, so this is my third year as artistic director. But I first came in 2003, I believe it was, as music director. That's when Vern Sutton was the artistic director, and I came and conducted two productions and recruited the orchestra. And I did that for three summers and then did other things for a couple of years and then was back in 2011.
Wondering also, when you've chosen the series since you became artistic director, your choices, did you have sort of a backpack of favorites that you wanted to put on but had to decide to go slow first in your first two or three years but would come with all sorts of ideas in place as to how you wanted to approach each one?
Well, there are a couple of factors, of course. First and foremost is that we're a training program for young singers, primarily graduates, but also some young professionals. And they're most interested in doing works of the standard repertory. And not unlike the symphonic world, there are a certain number of works that just keep popping up on professional companies and symphony orchestras' programs every year. You know the Beethoven's Fifth and the Beethoven's Seventh Symphony are going to be sort of the bread and butter of orchestras, and they're going to show up every 5-6 years or so. Same thing with opera. You know, they talk about the ABCs of opera, Aida, Bohème, and Carmen. And I don't believe there's ever been a production of Aida at Inspiration Point, but Carmen and La Bohème are works that young singers want to do. They're works that audiences are totally in love with and do not tire of seeing and hearing. And so those are the works that we sort of form the foundation of what we do there. However, I think it's important to do new works and works that are challenging for the singers and instrumentalists, and also new works for the audience to fall in love with. My first year, we did Little Women by Mark Adamo again, and that is just destined to be a classic of the 21st century American opera repertory. Everyone knows the story from having read it. It's in English, wonderful characterization, and a bunch of roles that singers love to do. So I did that our first season. The works of Stephen Sondheim also are sort of a crossover between musical theater and opera. They share characteristics of both, and so last year we did Little Night Music and done Into the Woods before as well.
Vern Sutton, of course, was very much into new works.
Yes.
The short time he was at Opera in the Ozarks, and I enjoyed those. And I was just thinking, when you've got this connection with the tried and true and much loved and the need for young singers to have roles under their belt before they audition for other places, that you do perform a very needed and very much appreciated service for these young singers growing up, because some of them have already started off in programs to get some kind of background. And usually the ones who show up for your auditions in different places are eager to do more whenever you've published what season you're doing, depending on what has happened in the past. Do you have an opera program in Arizona?
Yes, we certainly do. We do two fully staged opera productions every year, one in November and the other one in April.
And do you find that your students, singers in Arizona, audition for you for Opera in the Ozarks?
Well, I encourage them to do other things. They get their fill of me for, it's 7-8 months. So, and there are many other programs out there. But I do have singers that come from opera, from University of Arizona to Opera in the Ozarks every year.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Have you noticed any kind of change in the attitudes of young singers these days?
Well, I think everyone needs to be much more entrepreneurial. And with social media and websites, it's much easier to do so. It's now possible for singers to, produce their own CDs.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a couple good microphones and some editing software and a laptop and a quiet space to do it in, you can make quite a wonderful CD or audition video. It's much more hands-on. And, of course, Facebook and the easy availability to design websites just make it all the easier to market oneself. There are more singers than ever. The competition is very fierce for, that makes it sound violent, and it's not so. But there are lots of singers out there, lots of people that want to follow this dream of being a professional singer or a teacher. Competition's very stiff.
Those videos, does that help with the audition process, that you can make a wider choice because of the ones that you actually see in situ and the ones who send you their videos?
Yeah, well, most I do see live, and I really prefer that. I have the opportunity to speak with someone, hear them live in a room, and interact with them a little bit. That's the way I prefer it. But I do have many people posting to YouTube, in which, they'll upload some video, and with a camcorder and a computer, again, it's very simple to do. They send me a link, and there they are with three arias to sing for me, and it's very, very easy. It's also wonderful to be able to access and hear them over again. I take a camcorder with me on my audition tour and record everybody, because if, I hear a singer in Houston in December, when it comes time to make decisions in February, I sometimes like to, go back and check my notes and see if my first impressions were the correct ones.
Then when you come to Opera in the Ozarks, you've already got some of the major roles in place?
Oh, everybody's in place.
Oh, great.
Back in the olden days, an Opera in the Ozarks in its 63rd season this year,
I know.
Students would show up and they would audition once they get to Inspiration Point, and from that point on, they learn their music there and are assigned roles. That, I can't imagine doing it that way, but it was done that way. But no, everything is precast before they get here. I think singers want to know what they're going to be doing for the summer instead of betting a little bit whether they're going to get the lead role in The Marriage of Figaro or not. Everything's determined. Everybody's working on their scores now, or they'd better be. I'm going to be behind once we get there.
Yes, you want to have them at least word perfect, as you might say, in terms of getting down to the nitty-gritty of actual rehearsing the productions that you are hoping to present.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
The choices are the Elixir of Love. Elixir, will you do it in English or in Italian?
No, we do most everything in Italian now because we have super title capability, and I think that's best for the singers. They, of course, want to do it in the original language. They need to do that. But the immediacy of the text with the super titles is just something fantastic for the audience and a real breakthrough in the last 15 years.
Oh, yes, indeed. And then Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates, of course, is always a fair. I read a thing, I think it was in Opera News, wasn't it, about Gilbert and Sullivan, and this was a tongue-in-cheek production, especially written for the American audience, because they had violated all the copyright laws that were in place in England when Pinafore came out. They all loved it so much. They
would put I hadn't imagined, hence the Pirates.
So the Pirates, apparently, was specifically for American audiences when it was composed.
I didn't know that. I'll have to look at that article up.
Yes, and so that's in English. And then you're doing Bohème as well?
No, Madama Butterfly this year.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that's right. You've got all those essential principles in place. And it's, I suppose, something when you call them to say, we'd like you to try this. Do you do double casting still?
Yes, we double cast and double cast only. You know, we do 8 performances of every opera on the stage. And so part of a real calling card for Opera in the Ozarks is the ability to give singers, the lead singers, an opportunity to sing 4 performances, 3 or 4 performances of the role or roles that they've learned, so that over the course of the month of performances from mid-June to mid-July, they have 4 opportunities so they can continue growing with the role and the experience and putting more polish on, leading to the final week of performances.
Yes, and they've got great things to look forward to. Some of those young singers are doing amazingly. I mean, you mentioned Mark Delavan, and I'm in agreement with your comments about his Votan, but I also saw him in Francesca da Rimini, and I thought he was superb in that.
Well, he's really at the top of his career, for sure. But to be singing Votan at the Met after having sung who knows what on that tiny little stage at Opera in the Ozarks, it just goes to show that put one foot in front of the other and take the opportunities as they come. You never know where things are going to turn up, you know, with a lot of good luck and blessings and help along the way. The sky's the limit. You know, Latonia Moore, who was a student at Opera in the Ozarks less than a decade ago, is Aida at the Met, I think it was last season. And Jennifer Zetlin, who was in a production of Orpheus in the Underworld when I was there in 2005, here we are 8 years later, and she's going to be singing at the Met in a new opera. I'm not sure what the title is. It's not a standard piece. It's a daring new piece. We have an important function in their development, and it's really wonderful to see familiar names on the, you know, the back page of Opera News as they're looking through every month at who's doing what where.
What's the first thing you do when you get to the point?
Unpack my car.
That's an obvious question. Yes.
Back up to my cabin and take 10 weeks worth of clothing and scores and books out and insect repellent. Unpack that. And then I head down to the theater and see what our scenic designer, Spencer Musser, has been up to. He gets a head start on building the set. So I check in with them and go greet the year's kitchen staff, because it takes, you know, volunteers and work campers to, you know, feed and house and maintain the campus for 90 or so, well, maybe 80 or so instrumentalists and vocalists. It all starts with greeting the people that make it work. We dig into rehearsal.
And the other directors are there at the same time as you?
Yes. We all arrive. We have meetings and production meetings, and then the artists arrive that day and sing the next, and we're off and running, and it's like we put our nose to the grindstone and don't pick it up until the 19th of July.
That was Tom Cockrell in his 3rd season as music director for Opera in the Ozarks at Inspiration Point, just west of Eureka Springs. The season opens June 21st and runs through July the 19th, with 3 operas alternating in repertory, opening with Puccini's Madama Butterfly, Friday, June the 21st, Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance, Saturday, June the 22nd, then Donizetti's Elixir of Love, Tuesday, June the 25th. Performances at 7:30 at Inspiration Point, 4 p.m. at Bentonville's Arendt Arts Center. For details and tickets, call 479-253-8595 or visit opera.org. As always, there was a very interested group of supporters to hear Bob Hupp, Arkansas Rep's producing artistic director, announce on March the 4th the lineup of plays in the 2013-14 season. Three musicals, two straight plays, and a whistle-stop whisk through Shakespeare for the main stage subscription series, with Chicago's second city to add to the mix. Bob Hupp came to the station to discuss the choices and what has to be considered when designing a season, and I asked him if, each time, he has had in mind a plan on which to build.
There isn't any one particular formula or plan that dictates how each season unfolds. Different set of circumstances, different plays that I might see, different rights opportunities may come along to influence how a season takes shape. A season is often shaped around one or two large projects. The other plays are slotted in around those larger projects. There are several very practical factors, like how many actors we're hiring over the course of a season. So if I have a cast that has 24 actors, I need to have a cast that has two actors. And that's just simple economics.
And then when you come to the larger number that's almost always a musical or something that borders on a musical that demands that size of a cast.
Well, usually.
Or Shakespeare.
Exactly. One of the two, usually. A large American classic might call for 18 or actors, but a musical usually calls for 21 to 24, and that's a significant cast size for us.
And this season, you have three musicals.
In the last 10 years, there's usually been three, sometimes four musicals in a season. Our audiences respond very positively to musicals. We have a reputation for doing large-scale musicals well, and so there are often musicals in the season. What's interesting about the upcoming season is the fact that there are two premieres. That's unusual. We had the premiere of Treasure Island in the current season, and having two premieres next season is something that we haven't done during my tenure at the Rep.
The first one, Power Joey, has sort of been reworked.
That's right. It's a re-envisioning of the Rodgers and Hart classic musical. The storyline is the same. There have been some changes to the storyline, and some songs from other musicals from the catalog moved into this production. So with the blessing of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Foundation, which controls the rights to the Rodgers and Hart musicals, we have their blessing. We have the incomparable skills of Peter Schneider from the Disney, formerly of the Disney Corporation, who produced Beauty and the Beast on Broadway, won a Tony Award for that, and he's helming this project of Pal Joey, which is the first premiere of our season.
There are those who feel that Rodgers and Hart, that pairing, though Rodgers and Hammerstein is fantastic and does so much, that there was something very special about the Rodgers and Hart partnership.
Well, I agree. And I think Pal Joey is one of those musicals that never got its fair shake, never got its due. I mean, there have been several attempts to create the big hit with Pal Joey on Broadway, and it has never really hit home the way that those of us who are fans of the musical think that it might. This reinterpretation of Pal Joey is an attempt to move in that direction. Now, our production, Pal Joey is an African-American performer coming up through the ranks sort of parallel to the Jackie Robinson story.
Ah.
And so I think that that fresh take on an African-American entertainer looking to break through what is essentially a color line in the late 1940s will resonate. And I think that that new approach is something that I think gives new life to this musical.
And the other premiere is the Because of Winn-Dixie.
That's right. And that's the holiday show for us.
And the Winn-Dixie is the name of the hero of the musical.
That's right. The hero being
a
dog. You know, everybody, I think, is familiar with the novel Because of Winn-Dixie, which is particularly attractive in households that have young daughters. It's read in a lot of schools. And it'll be the first sort of Broadway-bound musical to ever star a dog. And one of the forces behind the musical is the Brilloni family. They're our foremost animal trainers for performing animals, and the dog has already been cast, and the dog is already in rehearsal along with the dog's understudy at their home in Connecticut, at their farm in Connecticut. Also exciting about the production is that the music is being written by Duncan Sheik. who wrote Spring Awakening on Broadway, who was, you know, a pop star in the 90s, who then went on to create for Broadway. And I love the music that he's written for this production.
Yeah. And then you're bringing back Les Miserables.
Yes.
And it's going to be very interesting to see. Have you got a different crew putting it together or bringing the same one back?
The crew is still taking shape right now. Les Mis was the most popular production in the Rep's 37-year history, the highest grossing show we've ever produced. And when we produced it in 2008, it was always our intention to bring it back. And we weren't quite sure when. And of course, the Cameron Mackintosh people dictate when that will happen, because when we did it in 2008, they pulled the rights off the market in 2009, and this is the first year they've put the rights back into the regional theater market. So this is the first time we've had the opportunity to do Les Mis, and we're partnering with our friends in Phoenix, the Phoenix Theater in Arizona, where we partnered with them the last time. There was such demand for the production when we did it in 2008. Certainly the movie factored into our decision. I enjoyed the movie. I enjoyed the epic scope of the movie. The emotional impact of film is visual. To me, the power of Les Mis is being in an intimate setting there with live actors who are trained in theater and who are trained to sing those songs the way they were written. I think Les Mis is one of the most powerful musicals that has been created in the last two decades. So I feel that when we have the opportunity to bring that story to life on our stage for our audiences, we should. We are talking about creating a new set design for the production. My objective is not to recreate the production we did in 2008. In fact, I want to make sure we don't do that.
When you had it in your mind to do it again at some point commercially and appropriately away from the first one, talking it over with the folk at Phoenix, how do you work in a partnership like that? Do they work with you in terms of ideas and looking at them compared with yours of certain scenes and certain voices, that there is partnership not only in just showing it in two cities, but in the other city having sort of an imprint on it?
Well, yes. Each project only has one director, and that director is going to call the creative shots in the project. What we've done is assembled members of the team in Phoenix. In other words, our choreographer will come from Phoenix, and a lot of our cast will come from Phoenix. Last time we did it, the productions were 6 months apart. This time, they'll be back-to-back. That allows me to hire more Phoenix actors. It allows us to have perhaps take some of our Little Rock actors to Phoenix. The objective is to have a cast that can primarily do the work in both cities. So the choreographer, the assistant director will come from Phoenix. The rep will contribute the director and the costumes and the set design. And then we will collaborate on the casting. The artistic director at the Phoenix Theater and I will hold auditions in Phoenix and in New York and in Little Rock. And we'll collaborate on the various roles that remain to be cast. And so we've had a great relationship with the Phoenix Theater in Phoenix. We did Hairspray together. And that production originated in Phoenix and came to us. Les Mis originates here and goes to them.
After all the musicals, in between each, you have a play, a drama. Red is very definitely a recreation of a real person's life, an artist trying to make his way in the 20th century.
It's an interesting story. It's about the American abstract artist Mark Rothko, and the play is set in the 1950s. When he's sort of at the height of his creative powers, and it's set in his studio on the Bowery in New York City. It's a conversation about the nature of art. He's hired a new apprentice to work with him, and that apprentice challenges a lot of the assumption and ideas. Rothko was a very forceful man, a very larger-than-life force of nature. And this play, which will star Joe Graves as Mark Rothko and Avery Clark as his assistant, bringing two rep favorite actors in the same production. But the play, the reason we chose to do Red, and it's a play that's been on my radar screen since I saw Alfred Molina do it on Broadway a couple of years ago, is that just coincidentally, the Arkansas Art Center, had planned to do a Mark Rothko exhibit in the fall of this coming year. Once I knew and once I had the conversation with Todd Herman that they were definitely going to do the Rothko exhibit, it seemed a no-brainer that we would do a play about Mark Rothko. Not only is it a great play, but the unique opportunity for our audiences and the patrons of the Art Center and everybody from Central Arkansas to go to the Art Center and experience Rothko's work and then come to the Rep see him come to life on the stage in a very dynamic production is a unique experience and one that I felt we really needed to jump on. And that's why Red is in the season.
No, it makes pure sense to do that. It's about time you brought Joe Graves back.
Well, you know, Joe lives in Beijing and he's not always available, but he was excited to do Red.
And then you've got a new play. Is it Cliburn Park?
Cliburn Park. Cliburn Park is one of the most interesting plays I saw in New York last season. Won the Pulitzer Prize for Best Drama. Won the Tony Award for Best Play, and deservedly so, I think, because it's so cleverly created. It's the story, you know, we know the plot of A Raisin in the Sun,
indeed.
Lorraine Hansberry's classic that The Rep produced a couple of years ago, and we know it's about an African-American family set in the 1950s in Chicago buying a home in a white neighborhood. Cliburn Park is about the family, the white family, that sold their home to the younger family from Raisin in the Sun, and what happens to them. What's unique about the play, besides the fact that it is actually has incredible humor, the first act is set in the 1950s when the home is being sold and what breaks loose in the neighborhood when all the neighbors find out what's happening to the home. And then the second act fast forwards to the 1990s when the home has fallen on hard times and an African-American family, you know, who still owns the home is thinking of selling their home to a young white family. The white family plans to tear the house down and build a new modern home, and the neighborhood is in an uproar. And so you really get the mirror image of A Raisin in the Sun,
mm-hmm.
and it's clever, it's theatrically innovative, and I think our Rep audiences will really enjoy this production, and it will be directed by Cliff Baker, and it's been a couple of years since our founder directed a play at the Rep.
Yes. Now, is Bruce Norris white or African-American?
You know, I actually don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure.
I was trying to figure out how you would describe it. You say it's so funny, but it's not a comedy. It's sort of a bitter comedy.
It employs significant humor to make a very important point about how race relations have evolved and how that's impacted real estate and urban planning. You know, you can look at Little Rock. You can look at what happened to the neighborhood around Central High after 1957. You can look at so many actions that occurred in Little Rock that are reflected in this play, for good and bad. It's thought-provoking, but it's so well-crafted, you enjoy it. And at the same time, you understand that it's significant in terms of its message.
It'd be very interesting picking a cast for that, I would think.
We'll have a very good time in New York and here in Little Rock doing the auditions for that production.
Yeah. And then you wind up with it's almost an unassailable classic of its kind.
Right.
The complete works of William Shakespeare, abridged. Have you directed that before?
I haven't. Nicole Capri will direct that production for us, and she suggested it to me. And it's a play that I had been familiar with for a number of years. It had been on my short list for years in the past and had just, for a variety of reasons, not ended up in the season. It's three actors. It's in a way, it's kind of like The 39 Steps, which is the Hitchcock spoof. This is a spoof of Shakespeare's plays. You don't really have to have a thorough understanding of Shakespeare to appreciate how uproariously funny this play is, where they tackle all of Shakespeare's plays in about 90 minutes.
It's constantly on the radar in some town or another.
And of course, that really is a tour de force for three actors and gives the opportunity for those three actors to really shine. But it's very clever and very funny. And so I think it's a great way to round out the season. Next year, we will be bringing back Second City. The Comedy Improv Troupe will be back for 2 weeks, and we'll continue our partnership with Ballet Arkansas.
Arkansas Rep's 2013-14 season, outlined by Bob Hupp, Rep's producing artistic director. The season opens with a revised version of the Rodgers and Hart musical Pal Joey, September the 6th. Season tickets still available online at www.therep.org. A quick arts calendar update. In Little Rock, Arkansas Rep's production of Avenue Q runs through June the 30th. The Hot Springs Music Festival closes today. In Fayetteville, the Walton Arts Center's Artisphere Festival continues with chamber concerts today and tomorrow. And on the 21st, the Artisphere Orchestra presents a concert with an all-Beethoven evening, the Triple Concerto and Symphony No. 7. Then finally, on June the 28th, The Artisphere Festival closes with a final concert by the Artisphere Orchestra presenting Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 and Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 5. Be sure to check our online calendar at kuar.org. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.